Hello, and welcome to episode 32 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I am joined by a good friend of mine and my former boss, Dr. Lisa. She didn't want her last name included on the show because apparently she is more concerned about her public image than I am. Shocking, I know. But Lisa is easily the best boss I've ever had, and I am so excited to finally get her on the show. She's one of the reasons this show exists, because of the kinds of conversations her and I always had when we worked together a few years ago. Lisa and I talked about our journey to launch the one-to-one program at our school, the building relationships with your students, and all the challenges in our way to do that, the importance of trying new things and encouraging your staff to do so as well, and the power of recognizing the talents in others. So, sit back and enjoy episode 32 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dr. Lisa, name redacted. Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. I am joined today by someone who is the third and final inspiration piece of this show happening, and is a good friend of mine, someone who I cannot at this point in my career say there's anyone I've more wanted to work for or more want to work for in the future going forward. And that is, I guess we're just going to say Dr. Lisa, because she doesn't want her last name on here, but that's fine. But Dr. Lisa, who was the assistant principal at the school I'm at now and is the one who helped me transform that school from paper and pencil all the time to 100% digital, pretty much overnight, it felt like. And so, hey, Lisa, what's going on?
Hey, Brad. Thanks for having me. I'm glad we finally made this happen.
Yeah, your scheduling is almost as much of a nightmare as mine. And so it has taken us like 11 months to actually get this interview scheduled, it feels like. And whereas Jay and Kristen, who are the other inspirations, were in like episode 1 and 4, you're all the way up in episode like 32. So
it'll be worth the wait, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. As before we recorded, we're talking about your inflated opinion of yourself. We're going to kick off right there. That works. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are, your background, without exposing your last name and keeping your anonymity?
Okay, so I have been in education for about 11 years now. I was a teacher at the middle school and high school level. I have been a social studies instructional coach, and also I did MTSS. I have been an assistant principal, and I am currently an assistant principal of instruction.
Cool. And then like you said, we met at the school we worked together at. We worked together at a school, and you were the AP who helped me transform a digital program or create a digital program my first year out of the classroom. And we kind of both were new to that school at the same time and kind of built a lot of stuff together and, you know, became good friends. Not that we see each other as often now that you're at a different school, and it makes me sad, but you know, it's been an interesting journey in education for you, I think. I think you've had a lot of interesting experiences at our district.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've had a lot of, different experiences, and I think when we had worked together at the first school that I was an assistant principal at, there was just a really good dynamic and a really good core group of people that were very passionate about kids and technology. So,
agreed. And it was, I've talked before on the podcast about some of the craziness that happened as a result of some district decisions and ending up not going with our platform and restarting again and again and again. And even that second year when you had left and we started platforms over again, it was the systems that you put in place and helped me put in place that got our school to where it is again with a second platform change. You know, that's the kind of thing that it sticks. You know, I think it sticks in a lot of ways, and it may not be measurable in a test score or in school grades or whatever else, but those are the kinds of things that I think an assistant principal and ultimately a principal can really have an impact on are the culture and the feeling of a school and the workload that ends up being on a teacher and the systems in place. I think those may not be measurable in the way that we would always like, but I think those are the critical parts. And in my experience, you're one of the best, if not the best, at it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think that when, because the teachers ultimately are what's going to sustain it. You know, the administrators, it seems like we're always moving around, and even instructional coaches change sometimes. So you try and put strong systems in place. But I think just starting, you know, from the ground up and kind of building what it was, I think we built that on the why, and we built it on the passion that we had, and tried to transfer that and just lead by example, and just by being excited about it, because we legitimately were really excited about it. So I think
obsessed is probably a more accurate phrase.
I think obsessed maybe is a better phrase. But I think the teachers saw that. So regardless of the platform, I think we ultimately just ended up getting them really excited about just kind of how they could transform their classroom. They saw it with one platform that they loved, of course. But once they saw that change, just because the platform changed, I think they already had buy-in at that point. And so they weren't going to give that up and be defeated just by, you know, a platform change.
Agreed. You know, I think back to that first summer, and it's kind of a blur. When we were doing summer sessions with the staff literally every single week of the entire summer, where we both worked the entire summer nonstop. I think we each took 1 week off the entire time. And I remember running sessions with staff and running PD so that they could learn the tools and the platform. And you're off to the side at a desk, like building a diagram of how we're going to handle laptop distribution for 4,000 students coming up in like 2 weeks, and trying to like figure out the flow in our media center, how we're going to get 4,000 kids through this room, give them a laptop, get them all set up, and then get them on their way and try to do 4,000 kids in a week. And then that week of just complete chaos, and the whole first year of just, and I don't know if you agree, but it felt like running around putting out fires every second of every day. And it was just, well, I had a plan for today, but nope, because this has got to get fixed, or this person needs me, or this, everything's broken, and I got to go figure out this problem. And just the chaos of that first year. And, you know, it's something that I genuinely believe would have been worse had our dynamic not worked so well, mm-hmm. and the two of us being able to play off each other's strengths. You know, someone had to kill the bugs.
I agree. It was a lot of putting out fires. But of course, I'm very detail oriented.
So am I. So I'm very so, on top of details.
So I had diagrams for everything. You know, potential wait times at each station. So I think as much as possible, we kind of planned for what would go wrong and responses to that. But on a day-to-day basis, things would happen all the time. And then all of a sudden, I went from like having no technology background to just, you know, sending you emails or calling you on the radio and being like, I just installed somebody's printer, or I just, you know, I just calibrated their smart board and I think you were confused. I mean, all I know is that stuff was printing and I did it. And I don't know how that happened, but, you learn on the fly and you fix things, and then I watch Brad fix things, and then I just copy what Brad does, and then all of a sudden things worked. I think one of the best parts is when the teachers or the kids would come to us so frustrated, right? Like they would have their laptop wouldn't work all class, or like it hadn't worked for like the first five periods of the day. And then they'd bring it down to the tech room, and Brad would just like merely like float his hand over the top of the keyboard. And then all of a sudden everything would work. And they were like, how did you do that?
That still happens.
Yeah.
That still happens every day.
So when it started happening to me, it was even crazier, and I didn't believe it. I just started to learn all these little quick fixes, I feel like, mm-hmm. For all these common problems. But yeah, we definitely had to learn We definitely had to learn on the fly. One of the time intensive things was that summer training. Definitely, I think the easy way out would have been to bring all the staff in at once, but we never kind of went with the easy way.
Nah, why would we do the easy way? That doesn't make any sense.
You know, we wanted to do what was in the best interest of the teachers and the kids, obviously. So,
well, I think that says a lot about both of our styles and back to our passion of, you know, we knew, yes, we could do the easy way out and we might get half of our staff to come to an ascribed. There's 1 week of the summer you can come to and we might have gotten half of our staff to have been there. But instead, we basically offered it every week of the summer. So that we got 90% of our staff to actually come to summer training for a full week each. Yeah. And that doesn't happen. You know, that doesn't happen anywhere that I know of. To get 90% to come to optional trainings is insane to me. It's still something that I have a hard time buying into. And on top of that, we had deliverables and activities and assignments to go for them and they had to do work and they did it. Like the vast majority of our teachers did the deliverables and learned something from it. Like, that's something that I still haven't been able to replicate a second time without, you know, being willing to do every single week in the summer. And now I'm not willing to do that. So,
and, yeah, I just, and there were small groups obviously because we offered so many sessions. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to an auditorium full of people that are disengaged, you have smaller groups of three or four tables of teachers sitting in front of you. So.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's going to lead nicely into my first question. And I will say for my audience, you know, my audience is used to this at this point. My guests are rarely prepared. What they don't know is that I know Lisa and I know how much it is killing her that she doesn't know what I'm about to ask her to the point that she texted me again today. And it's like, so what are we going to talk? Like, what's the topic? What are we talking about? And all I replied was education. And she just, wow, that's helpful. So it's killing her a little bit inside. And I can just kind of drag it out slightly to just make it a little worse. But my first question for all of my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today? I really hope you can hear that horn in the recording. Just some car, just some truck just screamed on a horn with the best timing ever.
The biggest problem facing education today. I don't know. That's a tough one. I think there's a lot of things, obviously, a lot of challenges. I think we struggle, with having stability a lot of time. There's just so much change, and while that can be a good thing, and I'm not just talking like a change in platforms or a change in curriculum or something like that, but just teacher turnover, admin change. Everything is just so fluid that when you think you're building momentum, sometimes it's just very hard to see things through. So I think that's one of the challenges. And then, you know, depending on where you are, I currently work at a Title I school, and you know, the kids bring with them a lot of challenges too. So that's just very difficult because, you know, we're asking a lot of teachers today, and I feel like the environment has changed pretty significantly, even in just the last 10 years, from when I was in the classroom to now. You know, you need to be able to deal with, you know, social emotional issues that, students have, and you're just dealing with a lot. It's a lot more than just knowing the curriculum and coming up with a great, lesson plan. And then I think there's a little bit of a loss of autonomy for the teachers.
And those two things don't exactly go hand in hand. I mean, you're talking about a situation where teachers have to take a very personal look at what is being done, at the student in front of them, because every student brings different baggage. And I think they bring, and we could argue it, but I think they bring more or more difficult or more painful baggage than they used to. Mm-hmm. I think that's the fair assumption. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're definitely bringing baggage regardless. And we're taking that autonomy and that personal aspect away from the teachers, but asking them to deal with each student as an individual. I always feel like there's kind of a disconnect there.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's just a lot of demands. Of course, there's more. Of course, there's more accountability with testing and all of that stuff. I don't think that anybody in education is opposed to accountability. But everything is, you know, everything is very focused on the test. And when it gets to be that way, I think sometimes we might lose a little bit of the creativity that maybe teachers had more flexibility with in the past.
It's interesting to me because, like, if you really think about the way we've changed standards, like going to Common Core, or in our case, Florida State, which is, as we know, Common Core plus cursive, going to Common Core or Florida State standards, actually, if you really look at the standards, should provide a lot more autonomy for teachers because they're not content driven really anymore. They're not specific to the content. I always think about English, and the standard is about the skill, and you can lay whatever content you kind of want on top of that, as long as it's at the appropriate, you know, lexile level and reading level and a challenge for the kids. But, and yet simultaneously, we are sort of we're simultaneously providing a framework for more freedom and giving them less autonomy and freedom and creativity in the classroom. And then those of us, or at least the structural system, the legislature of sorts, or the administration of sorts, but then simultaneously conversations like this podcast are saying that the teachers have to take creativity and freedom, and that the students need to be using that, exercising the same creativity and freedom to get them where they need to be.
I think there's a fight between competitiveness and collaboration. So in the education environment, it's not like a business as much as we want to make it like a business. You have to collaborate, share ideas, help other people out. But at the same time, there's all these things in place that would cause people not to want to do that. Right. So you have incentives for your kids passing, you know, AP tests. Right. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily prohibit you from sharing those ideas and having someone next door to you be just as successful. But there's incentives for being effective or highly effective. And so to me, when I'm spending hours and hours and hours on the weekend planning lessons and putting all this work in, you know, to not only have good evaluations, but to have the greatest impact on my kids, you know, how much time do I have to spend in, you know, PLCs or after school really helping somebody who maybe lacks a lot of the content knowledge I have? They're maybe not as strong as a teacher as I am. And so it's, I think there's a lot of back and forth. It seems like we put in place all of these incentives, and even within a district, I think school to school, we should be like sharing the best ideas and the best practices, but then you're constantly being compared to, you know, the school down the street or the school across town and this and that. So why am I going to call the other school and reveal the, you know, it was the same kind of thing. I think when we were transitioning to digital, we had put in so much work. I mean, so much work. And then when somebody says, well, can you give me your plan for distribution after not doing anything to come up with a plan? You're kind of like, you should share, but at the same time, you're like, no, we put in all of this work, like, you know?
You know, I think I agree. I think that the way I look at it is it's the combinations of the fact that we are all here because we want to help kids, right? I mean, that's like at the heart of what we do is we want to do what's best for kids. And in the simplest terms, helping another school is good for kids as a collective whole. It's not good for the kids at my school per se, but it's good for kids. And so I should want to do that. But then you're right. The other side of it is the hours I have put in, and now someone else, it feels like, wants to cheat those hours. Uh-huh. And
again, we talk about inflated, you know, impressions of yourself. Our plan was the best plan. So we should give it freely to everyone, but there's even naturally here while we're having this discussion, there's still a disconnect of like, I don't want someone else taking credit for my plan.
If I spend 3 hours doing my math homework, I don't want to hand it to you.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's the same thing, but at least there would be a learning factor, right? Like, so I'm not helping you by giving you my math homework because you need to learn the math work. You need to learn the math. Actually, I could have a whole discussion about the value of math, but let's just say that I thought you needed to learn math, then I wouldn't help you to give you, but if another school is asking you for resources, you're helping them. There was no value for me of doing the work. I didn't learn more again about the content knowledge I already knew. I just developed the materials I needed to do it with the students. So it still helps other students. It doesn't hurt the person I'm giving it to. There's no loss there. But you're right. There is an inherent competitiveness and value to what I'm doing. And I don't think that's recognized. And even if it's recognized, it's hard to balance that. Yes, it's good for kids. I'm not being compensated for that thing. I'm doing well above and beyond, and I'm already doing above and beyond to create it in the first place. Now you want me to do it for someone else too.
Mm-hmm. And there's all these different monetary incentives too. You know, if you're at an A school or if you're with a certain population of kids, you may be able to get way more AP passers than you would somewhere else. So, mm-hmm. We might be drawing teachers out of places that really, you know, need the best teachers.
You've effectively ignored the best or the biggest portion of my question. You effectively ignored the word biggest and you just
shattershoot
everything. There's just a lot of them. There's just a lot of them. There's just a lot going on. What's the path forward? If there are that many problems, how do we fix? Because it feels like you can't really fix in isolation because all these problems are sort of interconnected in a lot of ways. And that's why I feel like, well, while you did kind of cheat the system, they are all kind of interconnected. Parts of them connect into the next thing. So you can't just sort of fix one in isolation and hope it doesn't.
Change starts at the top to me from what I've seen. If you kind of see dysfunction places, I always kind of look at the leader, like who's leading that. And I think it's one of the biggest reasons that we were able to make such an impact, with digital curriculum, because we had this very solid core group of people on the leadership team, that we weren't going to let it fail. We were very passionate about it. And I just think if you can build those, like a really strong core leadership team, that can create sort of a culture, you know, I was almost going to say like a family sort of atmosphere, where everybody feels like they're in it together and you're really with people that share the same values as you, because that's when you're going to get people to work for you. I mean, you're never going to get an entire staff of everyone on your staff is going to be amazing. That's not going to happen, but it's about building people and it's about getting buy-in. And I think when you have people that have a really strong belief system, and they know that you care about the kids, they want to work for you. And if you build the right culture, it's just an environment that you want to be in. So then, you know, you're going to have less turnover and all that sort of stuff.
So we would point to the principal at the point. No, but I have to point out. So when we were rolling out digital, I think I agree. There's the third member of our team in that sense. Well, I should say our fourth member, because Brenda absolutely was an essential part of that team. But also, you know, Brenda was absolutely critical and still is to my program. But also, we had a principal that was 100% on board. Mm-hmm. We had Doug, who was 100% on board digital. Yes. You know, that was his focus, yes, and he was with it. And so there was that alignment, yes, that core group of alignment. But the other thing Doug did was he was more than willing to say, that's not what the district wants, but they're wrong. We're doing it our way. And so
that was his school. And so you have ownership in your school, you know, and ultimately the results fall back on you. So you have to make those decisions.
But I think the shirking, what I mean is the willingness to buck the system or go rogue of sorts is the same quality that I admire in that situation. Mm-hmm. Could be a negative if I have a teacher who wants to buck the system and say, I don't think digital is good for kids. And there could be some research to even support that. And so, but if that doesn't go in line with where I'm at, so that's a negative. So can you, yes, you can affect some level of change at a principal level or an AP level maybe. But if you ultimately have an area super or a superintendent who's not on board, and then ultimately if you have state legislation who's not on board, and then ultimately if you have federal, so the,
I think you have to show them, like, I don't want to say like prove them wrong, but you do, like, it speaks for itself. So when you walk, okay, so maybe Doug disagreed with some things or said, okay, we're not going to listen to this, or we're going to go this way instead. But when people came out and they did a walk, or they talked to our teachers and saw what was happening in the classroom, where they talked to the kids, that it's really like, it's undeniable at that point, what was happening. I mean, that was 4 years, 3-4 years ago, mm-hmm. at this point. And I mean, it was just referenced recently how excellent the implementation was, and you know, why we're not there everywhere else. So I think when you just have a really strong conviction, you have just research and common sense to back up your reasoning, and then you just have results, you know? When you walk around and you see what's happening, I think that's enough to kind of convince people. And I think that's what we do with the teachers too, because I mean, we can't pretend like from day one, all of our teachers were on board. You're never going to get that. There's a lot of resistance, and everybody, you know, some people just like to ask a lot of questions to ask a lot of questions. Some people legitimately have questions. Everybody's level was very different. So we were very specific to try and figure out where people were and then provide PD based on the level that they were at. So I think we did. Like, I mean, we even went, I mean, you're still making individual appointments to meet with people and help them. So when they see that kind of support, there's no, it eliminates excuses. So a lot of the original pushback is maybe like, yeah, this is here, it's going to go away, so I'm going to like push back for a little while. Well, it's not going away, and you don't have an excuse anymore that you don't have the support. You have the support. You know, we've had so many PDs, obviously. And then you have basically your own, you know, personal, like, you know, technology integration assistant that you can just make appointments with that will come in and do model lessons. I mean, we took people on instructional rounds to see what other people were doing. We had the teachers present to the teachers. So they were excited about what other teachers next to them were doing in their classroom. So a lot of things, I mean, there's always resistance, but I think if you just keep pushing forward, I think you can make it work.
Cool. Huh. Nice. Well, we didn't exactly hit the biggest problem, but I think we touched on a handful of things. And I think that interconnectivity is a factor. I want to go back a little bit to one of the other points you brought, and the student side of it, that this, you know, the students kind of each bring their own problems to it. Is that something new, or is it worse than before, or is there just some sort of openness to explaining it more than they used to be? What is it that makes that? Because I find it hard to believe kids had problems when I was in school, and kids had problems when you were in school. Like, all those things happened. So what is it that makes it feel like, at least, that they bleed more into a classroom now than they used to? What is that change to you, do you think?
You know what? I think there's a different, unfortunately, I think that there is a different dynamic between administrators, teachers, parents. For whatever reason, I don't know that I can pinpoint exactly why it is. I just know that when I was growing up, if I got in trouble in school, which I never got in trouble, but
of course not. You're perfect.
If I ever got in trouble or whatever, you know, a teacher called home or I, you know, missed a class or something, my parents would never, they would always assume it was my fault. They would, you know, that would be their first assumption, was that it was my fault and that I needed to fix it. You know, don't ever get in trouble again. Whatever you did wrong, I'd be like, but mom, that teacher is not good, or they're not very nice. They're like, I don't care. You're going to have to deal with difficult people. You're going to have to deal with whatever. You need to figure it out. Whatever you did wrong, fix it, you know? And so I don't know. I don't want to say that, but it seems like the dynamic is very different and it's much more adversarial. Like, the parents don't reach out to the teachers. Like if there's an issue, I mean, there's just so many occasions. I would say the majority of the time I talk to parents and they tell me about an issue with their child and a teacher, the parent has never spoken to the teacher before. They've never, reached out to the teacher. And that's one of the first questions I always ask them. Have you talked to the teacher? So I don't know. They, you know, their kids come home. They're very, you know, quick to make a judgment about, you know, whatever their child, said. And there's just less conversation, I think, between parents and teachers working together, which seems crazy to me because
it's so much easier to communicate.
and the goal for both the teacher and the parent are exactly the same. So that's the confusing part to me, because every teacher, they want their kids to be successful. Like I want a class of kids that have A's and B's, you know, maybe my strugglers have C, you know, I want my kids to show up. I don't want to call because you've missed 10 days of school or 12 days of school or 15 days of school. I want you to be there and I want you to just turn your work in and do your stuff. So the goal is the same for parents and teachers. I don't know if it was like that when you were in school or not, but I feel like,
I mean, certainly my dad as a teacher was like, it's your fault. It's mm-hmm. always your fault.
Yeah.
Like no matter what, it's your fault. And I think you're right. There is a,
and my parents weren't teachers. Yeah. So it wasn't, you know, I don't think that was just, you know, your dad, because he was in education,
right,
said
knew better.
That.
I think that was the standard. It's, if the teacher says you're wrong, you're wrong. I wonder if there's a, does that belay a little, a social shift in how we look at teachers in a sense? Like, is there sort of a more negative look at teachers as a broader picture at this point? Like,
definitely.
That those who can do and those who can't teach, is that really, is something like that the reason? Did just people look down on teaching as a career field in our country? Is it that simple?
Unfortunately, I think that's a part of it, just because I think it's maybe not as revered as some other professions.
You know? I've been toying with this idea of like the long, slow death of education, which is kind of, because I was talking on another podcast and we were talking about how with Shane Lawrence, and we were talking about like, you know, eventually education is going to die and it's going to start that process soon. And I said, well, I kind of feel like it started that process a long time ago. And I'm wondering if now for me, if I think about my own education and how I believe education was failing at its job when I was in school and before I was in school, you know, I think it's been failing at its job for a long time where it was just not hitting the majority of people. And yes, it hit some and some people got what they needed and everybody kind of got through it or whatever. A lot of people got through it. Lots of people did and they dropped out and they were let go. And I like it, if that's true, if it's been failing a long time, then now we're getting to a point where a generation of people who were dissatisfied with school and the teachers they had are now having kids and sending those kids to school where they have a mindset of the kind of teachers they didn't get anything out of when they were in school. And is this just kind of the payoff of a longer problem?
I don't know. I don't think that's it. I don't think it's like they're disgruntled at like the education that they received. I don't know. I just see a sort of, sometimes even, I don't know, even like a disrespect maybe from the students that I never kind of, And maybe it did exist when I was in high school and I just never saw it. I just never would have spoken to an adult like in a disrespectful manner or anything like that. Just sometimes some of the stuff that you see seem, I don't know. I don't know. Is that a cultural shift? Is that a just shift in family dynamics? Is that only in, you know, certain places as opposed to others? You know, I don't know.
Cool. Well, I think that's going to lead me to my second prepared question. And my second question is, I wish this were a video show just so you could see her reaction when I said second prepared question. It's just like everything like closes, her eyes are shut.
The last question?
No, we got three. This is only the second question. Okay. We're nice and slow.
Okay. So don't put a qualifier on it. Like, what's the biggest?
All three of them.
What's the worst?
Who's all three of them have qualifiers?
No,
get used to it.
No, I'm just remove them.
So the second question is, this one, if one is a qualifier, that's the qualifier here. But what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do? And I'll give you two options with this one. You can either go back to when you were in the classroom and something you did you wish all teachers would do. Or if you want to take it a different direction, what is something you do as a leader, as an administrator, that you wish all administrators would do? I'm going to give you an option here that I've never given anyone else before.
I'm going to go with when I was a teacher, and I would say just try new things. I think we're so, I don't know why. I just try and create a relationship with the teachers that I oversee to where there's no sort of, you can't do this. You can't do it perfectly, because when you oversee somebody, you evaluate them, and there's just inherently this sense of like nervousness sometimes when that person comes into your classroom or whatever. But I try and just create a relationship to where they know that that's not really my goal in observing them. I just want them to be able, to make a decision without thinking, well, if somebody walked in or if this was an evaluation, would I get rated low on this, sort of like the freedom to just try and fail. Try something, that is maybe, crazy, like that requires the kids to, act something out or something that maybe involves a lot of movement that really terrifies you to do with your kids, or a lesson you've never tried, or a debate sort of structure. Because the easy way out is, especially since at the high school level, I see a lot of people that are content experts. And so when you're a content expert, you want to talk a lot about what you know. So it is very, very easy to not plan like anything creative or step outside the box and go in. My background is social studies. And so I'll see that a lot in social studies classes where teachers just want to stand up and lecture. They know everything about the Civil War and every battle, and they want to tell you everything about it. And they might be really, they might be really excited about it too. But it's just easy to go in and talk at people. I just think try things without fear, try and fail. And then, teachers have been doing, like, there's so many good practices, I feel like, that sometimes new stuff comes along. I always felt like that in the classroom, or when I'd go to a training, sometimes I'd be like, I used to do that. Like, I did that in my classroom 3 years ago, and then for some reason I tossed it out. because, like, all of these new things keep coming, and you're like, I'm not gonna, it just sort of replaces the old, but I think some things are just like tried and true, and I don't know.
I feel like you managed to actually answer both questions, both sides of that question, in the teachers need to try new things, but as an administrator, you build a relationship that encourages trying new things. So I think you managed to hit both. So well done on that.
Okay.
You didn't answer the first question at all, but you answered the second question twice. So I think like we're on a balance right now. But I like that. No, I agree. I think the freedom to try new things. But then you qualify it at the end there with like, but at the same time, don't forget the stuff that does work. It's not lecture, just to be clear. Lecture probably doesn't work. 99% of the time, lecture doesn't work. And I will go that high, because there are times where it works. But
yeah,
don't forget the things that did work.
And you need direct instruction. You do. I mean, I think that's a component. That's one of the things I still remember from high school, is that my U.S. history teacher was a really great storyteller. And he told stories. You know, he didn't read from a PowerPoint. But he told you a story. And so some people just really have that ability. So I think that's valuable still.
Yeah. I think there's value in it, but in small chunks. And I will say, I think that's a social difference nowadays. These kids can't focus for more than like 5 minutes of direct instruction, in my opinion. Like 5 or 10 minutes is about the max.
But the teachers can't either. Well,
the teachers are hypocrites in trainings and can't stand to listen to someone else speak, but then we'll go stand in their room for 50 minutes.
But we have to make our trainings better. We have to make our professional development better, right?
Preaching to the choir on that one.
We have to model what we want to see in the classrooms, right? You want interactive classrooms. Well, you better have interactive PD, and, you know, you better be monitoring, or, you know, you better be demonstrating, you know, different strategies, different ways to monitor, stuff like that.
I like it. Absolutely. But no, I think I'm with you. Try new things. An administrator, make your staff comfortable trying new things. And I think that's critical. Can you, a little bit more for the administrative side, how do you build those relationships with your staff? How do you go about do you just blatantly say, I want you to try new things. Go try new things. Do the new things. I promise I'm not going to ding you on the new things. Like, is there something a little more to it?
That's my exact opening speech.
That's pretty much it.
That's how I start.
Welcome to, I'm new to this school and you're my people. Try the new, you guys can't see my hand gestures, but very wide. Try the new things.
Just that's the exact message I send at every opening, department meeting. Actually, usually the opposite of that. I lay out really high expectations. And then I think they might be a little nervous at first. but then I just meet with people in one-on-one settings, and I actually sit down, when you're supposed to have, outside of when you're supposed to have it. But then also when you're supposed to have pre-conferences and these kind of things, but having a real conversation with somebody, and not just like I have to meet with you before your lesson. So,
and then go through the checklist.
So then I
just answer this. What's your answer to this and this one?
Okay. Exactly. So to actually sit down and kind of say I'm the student. So I walk in and tell me what I'm going to be doing, and then but what about this? Do you think this would work better? Maybe actually really having conversations with them, because I mean,
coming almost more from like a coaching model than a leadership model in a sense, or a dictator manager
model. I think in my first 2 years, I still saw myself as an instructional coach. One, because I didn't have an instructional coach over my department, and I was previously an instructional coach. So it was such an easy transition for me. I almost didn't feel like their administrator. They probably didn't feel that way, but I was just doing the same thing I would do in coaching conversations. You know, after an assessment, we'd sit down and we'd look through the questions, like maybe this one was bad, or, you know, maybe we should have, you know, wrote it this way, or let's look at the standard. It wasn't really asking that, or this is why the kids got it wrong. Like little, really kind of diving into the content with them. So I think they knew too, you're not going to get away with a surface level conversation. I'm going to probe you more than that. So
cool. Awesome. Well, my last question, and it's the hard one.
Oh gosh.
Not really. It's the easy one. It's the softball at the end. Who is the greatest teacher you ever had?
Do I say a name?
You can.
Okay, so I'll just keep it general, and I will say that it was one of my, well, if I go back to high school, I would say my U.S. history teacher. But beyond that, somebody who's really like shaped the trajectory of my career, it would definitely be a professor that I had, in my master's and then my doctorate program. I never even thought about, doing my master's. And then when I made that decision, and then I had this professor, it just sort of, because I think mentor relationships have to be natural. I don't think you can force it. You know, here's your mentor, here's your mentee. It was never like that. I think you just naturally see things in people. It's just like building leaders in your school, teacher leaders, right? We had to pick people for our DCTL team. And you see something in somebody and you're like, I think that they could lead this PD. I think they could do this. I think they could be on this team. And so for me, she was that person. Like she said, you know, she was that person for me that like saw something in me that I didn't even see in myself, which was the reason I ended up, you know, getting my doctorate. That was never a goal or an ambition of mine. That was just a direct result of the relationship, that I had developed with somebody that was like, you would be great at this. You know, it's just one person saying, I think you'd be really good at this. And I was like, no. I'm like, I don't think so. I'm like, I don't think I'm, you know, like I'm still teaching. I'm not even the very best at this yet. Like I have to be the best at this. You know, I can't, how am I going to like, I have to be the best, you know? So I always want to do things to like perfection, you know, and feel like
I had no idea. That's news to me.
That's a fault. It's a good thing and a fault, I guess, at the same time. But yeah, she was definitely, the single, the person that really just like, she had a substantial impact, on me.
It's interesting that you kind of, you know, I've said a lot on my show that there's veins that connect all three of those questions. The questions are well thought out despite what you know about me. I actually thought about something ahead of time. And those three questions lend themselves to a natural vein, and you kind of hit on it for me. And that's that sort of identification of like that identifying things in people. Cause I think you kind of started with, there's all these problems the kids have and we have to identify those in a way, and all these problems that, you know, we have to identify. And then it's talking about building leaders in your staff and building leaders in each other. And even asking people to try something new is still asking, you know, recognizing those qualities they have and bringing those out through coaching and mentorship and relationships. And that, I think that's the common vein that runs through this discussion, is that relationship side of things is so absolutely critical. And if we go all the way back to the beginning, before we got to my questions, like that's what made us work so well together, was that relationship we had and recognizing the strengths each of us had and where we could help each other and benefit each other and where the rest of our team was. And I think that's probably, in my eyes, that's probably one of your greatest strengths, is that same ability that you probably learned on some level from this professor. Mm-hmm. So all those things just flow, just like a nice flow. It's like a
good questions.
It's almost like I know what I'm doing. 32 or 33 episodes in, it's almost like I know what I'm doing. I don't have a clue. This whole thing is a sham. House of cards waiting to fall down, but we'll get there one day. I do actually have for you, I have one last question.
Okay.
And this is a really good one. Cause I'm really,
what do I want to do when I grow
I'm
up?
Just curious. No. Yeah. What do you want to do when you grow up? No. My question for you is, and I just, for my own personal benefit, have you been trapped in your own home recently by any crawling vermin?
I have not had a bug sighting. No, I have not had a bug sighting. I am moving soon, to a new home. So this is terrifying to me. because, you know, I don't know this home. And so
it could have bugs in it.
It could have bugs in it, but
Lisa lives in the only house in all of Florida that has no bugs in it currently. And yes. I don't know why she's considering moving because it's literally the only one.
It is. It is. There are no bugs. And trust me, I scan the room before I enter. So I would know. I would know. And so, yeah, I'll be taking a lot of precautions before I move. The pest control people will be coming out and doing a thorough inspection. And then, you know, as thorough as you can get, you know, you take the sockets off, you get up in the attic, you go around the perimeter.
You guys, you don't see her face. She's 100% serious. Like, what my favorite Lisa stories, hands down, are bug related because she tells stories that to any human being listening to them is going, she's kidding, right? She's not, like, she genuinely checks for bugs before she enters a room because if there happens to be one near a door.
Then I'm trapped.
You're trapped. You can't. What do? You can't get out.
Did I tell you I didn't drive my car for a week because there was a frog in it?
You've told me. Yes. Yeah. You traded. Didn't you end up trading cars with somebody?
Yeah, I traded cars with somebody. Yeah.
Still my favorite though is the time you had the roach on your ceiling and you were late for work.
That was traumatizing. I'm surprised I made it in.
It was on the ceiling. She could have just walked past it.
No.
But. No, it's right there. You're trapped. What are you going to do?
I am. But listen, I'm taking precautions. Yeah. And I will make sure the company I hire is on call.
You still are the regular occurrence. Anytime someone sees a bug, they're like, oh, God, Lisa couldn't handle this. It's still regular because we, of course, have bugs all the time.
Yeah. What about the radio calls? I would call. I forget what the code is now.
No, I forget but the code.
It's a code, obviously, totally unrelated to a bug problem.
The day we had to lift up your entire desk on its side, empty all the drawers because she had seen a bug.
Yes, and I called on the radio and people responded rather quickly.
Oh, man. Lisa, hey, it's been fun both running down memory lane and also going through my show and my normal questions. I appreciate you being on the show. I really do. And I know normally this is where I would ask, how can people reach out to you? But since you're Lisa name redacted on my show, I can't. That's not going to be easy to do. They're not going to find you at Lisa name redacted on Twitter. But if you have questions for Lisa, you can always reach out to me and I can forward them along so that we can protect her anonymity.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again, Lisa, for joining me on the podcast. So much fun chatting with you, and you always genuinely push my thinking. If you have questions or comments for Lisa and want to reach out to her, too bad. But if you have questions, you can reach out to me, and I will be glad to pass them along. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Shuffler. I love to hear from you guys there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. I'm always looking to book more guests for the show. Until next week, go out and try something new. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.